session 28. Only five more than the last session. So session 28. So we're still in numbers. And last time we did a whole bunch of stuff. I don't want to recount it all, but well, there's going to be a lot of recounting when we get to Deuteronomy, because Deuteronomy, which means second law, is a repetition of everything that came before. I mean, it goes not only through the, it goes back through the Exodus, it goes back to all the law, it goes back to all the things that Moses heard from God. I mean, it's everything is repeated because the people are just about to go into the land. And so, because, as you remember, all the people that were there at that point, except Joshua and Caleb, were less than 20 when they left Egypt. So you had a whole, and they were, 60 by then. So you had all kind of people that were born in the wilderness who never really had, had never been in Egypt. Their parents, grandparents had died off as they were going. So they had to keep being re-instructed, It was kind of like, what we would say passing on the faith. It was kind of like, catechism, where, don't forget this, don't forget this. Think about this. When you get into the land, think about this. And so it restates everything, Deuteronomy. But Deuteronomy is told from Moses' point of view, not God's, as opposed to the other four books of Torah. Because, in the other four books, God is basically talking. But in Deuteronomy, Moses is talking. It's narrated by Moses rather than by God. We're going to skip through some stuff because we actually are in 28. Because where we left off last time, Joshua got appointed as Moses' successor. And remember, Joshua was very zealous for Moses. When the Spirit fell on the 70 elders and Eldad and Medad, who, were late for church, didn't get there in time. The Spirit fell on them, too, and they were, over in North Ridgeville prophesying. And so Joshua says, Moses, you got to make them stop that, because they weren't even here when it happened. So, Joshua's very zealous for Moses. And so he presents Joshua as the new leader, brings him in front of the whole assembly so everybody knows that now Joshua's in charge. But in chapters 28 and 29, it restates the feasts. Now, the Shabbat is always restated. The feasts are restated periodically. The feasts are restated with an emphasis on obedience to the law and to the fact that now people have grown up kind of wandering. I mean, if you were 50 years old, you would have spent your whole life wandering, pretty much. So if you were, say, born, a few months after they left Egypt, and you were 40 years old now, all you knew was, oh, the cloud's moving. Let's start packing up the stuff. Let's get the U-Haul and put the things, or, help me take these things down. That's all you knew. And you knew the tent of meeting, you knew the glory cloud, you knew, Moses, and you knew, some of the stuff, but you had never had like a permanent place where I live here and I go to church there. It's like you're just moving. So there's an emphasis on these people have to understand now that they're going to be in the land and this is really going to happen. And the covenant of law is really something that's so important on you all, y'all. It's really so important that when you get in the land, you have to understand God not only delivered you from slavery, but he gave you this land, so you got to keep his law, which, as we've seen, they don't. If you want to read some interesting stuff, the first 6-7 chapters of Jeremiah shows you what happens after they've been in the land for a while. So in these chapters, the sacrifices have, it always talks about how the sacrifices have a pleasing aroma to God. And that sounds pretty gross because they're burning animals. So it has a pleasing aroma to God because it's an atonement for sin. And it's a type. So the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross is, although brutal and horrible, is pleasing to him in the sense that Jesus is the perfect sacrifice and his blood is the ultimate atonement. So sacrifice is pleasing to him. It gets to the point where God commands that every day you sacrifice a lamb in the morning and a lamb in the afternoon. And this is going to go on in perpetuity, which is basically for the sins of the people. And you do this even on the Sabbath, even on the Shabbat, which God had never mentioned before. So this is why on Passover, as they added more and more traditions to the Passover, on Passover day at 3 p.m., the lamb that they killed, that evening prayer was not really evening, it was 3 p.m. So it was like sunrise or very early morning and 3 p.m. So they would offer on Passover a lamb in reparation for the sins of the people, almost like kind of a mini Yom Kippur, since it was a deliverance time at Passover. So when Jesus was dying on the cross at 3 p.m., they were killing a lamb. So they were killing a lamb for the sins of the people. And a couple miles away, he was dying on the cross for the sins of the people. So it's mind-boggling how this works out. Because even all these things, you know, God uses all these things to teach a lesson. I want you to do two lambs a day, do the second one at 3 o'clock. Well, the true lamb dies at 3 o'clock. You know, it's Passover. You know, spotless lamb, no defects. Spotless lamb, no defects. You know, nobody can go into the sanctuary. Nobody can go into the Holy of Holies. But then when the lamb dies, the curtain breaks, tears. The sanctuary is exposed. Two lambs, lamb in the morning, lamb in the late afternoon. And then there's also the concept of the new moon. There's offerings for the new moon. So remember, they have a lunar calendar. Not that they're praying to the moon, but you have a lunar calendar. So the month starts when there's the new moon. And the new moon has to be determined by spotters who officially say, it's the new moon. Which is basically, you don't, if you look carefully, well, in the city you don't even notice it, but if you look carefully, you see the disk of the moon was just kind of a pale light. That's why it had to be spotted. Obviously, much easier in those days to spot the new moon when you didn't have electric lights everywhere. And whether you were, even if you were in the middle of Jerusalem, it would have been pretty dark during the night. But there were two, you remember, they have to have two or three witnesses. So there have to be two spotters would say, there's the new moon. So they'd blow a trumpet. Great job if you could get it. You know, they blew a shofar, they blew a trumpet, they sent a message to the temple, the new month has now started. So there was always a little variation as to when the month started, because if the month ended today, but the new moon wasn't really spotted till tomorrow night, then the next month didn't start till tomorrow night. And this is interesting when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, because they called it the hidden feast, because it's the only feast day that depends on moon. It starts when the new moon is spotted. So if the new moon is spotted at, you know, 3 a.m. instead of 10 p.m., it's not the holiday until the moon is seen. But this uncertain time, it's called the hidden feast, some people attribute it to being like the second coming. You don't know exactly when it's going to be. There's a mystery to it. Like a lot of Jewish believers think Jesus is going to come back on Rosh Hashanah because of that, and because of the shofar announces it, like the trumpet blast, you know, when Jesus comes back, we're going to hear the trumpet blast. But getting sidetracked. So these things become so there's offerings. So let's go down to 28:16. He's going to recount about the Passover thing, if somebody wants to read there.
On the 14th day of the first month, of the Passover of the Lord. And the 15th day of this month is the pilgrimage feast. For 7 days, unleavened bread is to be eaten. On the first of these days, you shall hold a sacred assembly. And do not do no sort of work. As an oblation, you shall offer holocaust to the Lord, which shall consist of 2 bullocks, 1 ram, and 7 yearling lambs that you are sure are unblemished, with their cereal offerings of fine flour mixed with oil, offering 3/10 of an ephah of each bullock, 2/10 of the ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs. And after one goat as a sin offering in atonement for yourselves. These offerings you shall make in addition to the established morning holocaust. You shall make exactly the same offerings each day for 7 days as food offerings, in addition to the established holocaust, which is libation or a sweet-smelling oblation to the Lord. On the 7th day, you shall hold a sacred assembly. And
okay. So along with the Passover, along with each family having the lamb, you do all these other offerings as well. Every day during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, yes. Now that goes on for a week. And this is another example of blood. Everything is about blood. Passover is technically 1 day, but it starts the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is 7 days. And first fruits is also in there. So there's actually 3 feasts within a week. Okay, then it goes down. You see the, it mentions then the first of weeks, the Feast of Weeks, which is Passover, which is Shavuot. In fact, right now we're in the period, since we're in the period between Easter and Pentecost, in Hebrew terms, we're in the period between the Feast of First Fruits and Shavuot, which is Pentecost. And you have to count the days. Not made by a rabbi, it's God's law. You count each day as you go toward Passover. And you count 49 days, and then the 50th day is Passover. That's why in Hebrew it's Shavuot, which means the Feast of Weeks, because it's 7 weeks and then a day. And so it's called counting the Omer. Now, you know, at that time, there wasn't, you know, there weren't like 15 calendars in everybody's house and a calendar on the phone and a calendar, you know. You had to figure out, like, okay, what day is it today? You know, so they counted them. So it's called counting the Omer. There's also these feasts, you know, you can see here the Feast of First Fruits, you bring the cereal up. And it's interesting that flour is always involved. You know, there's always this connection to bread. Mm-hmm. There's flour offerings, cereal offerings. Mm-hmm. You know, you sacrifice the animal, but you also, you know, put flour in or wheat in or... Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. It's just like... you know, like the Road to Emmaus that I did Friday night, if you want to watch the YouTube. You know, it's word and sacrament, because Jesus does, they don't know it's him, but, you know, he does what I call the most awesome Bible study ever. They walk like 7 miles with Jesus explaining everything from Moses and the prophets, and their hearts are burning. They don't want him to leave. They're so excited they can't even stand it. And then when he goes inside, you know, he doesn't say, I mean, it's somebody else's house. It's not his house. He goes in and sits at the table and kind of takes over the table. You know, he becomes like the head of the Seder. You know, remember every Seder, there's a man who runs it. There's not like a committee of people that do it. And there's not like a guy over here and a woman over there who run it. Like one man runs the Seder. So he goes into somebody else's house. And these guys are probably like, gee, you know, we should have picked up some of these newspapers and magazines. We didn't know we were going to have company. And and he sits down, takes the bread, and he breaks it after saying the blessing. And that's when they recognized who he was. So, you know, he goes through word and sacrament, which is so cool. I mean, so powerful. And those guys, I don't know if they were at the Last Supper. It's not clear how many people were at the Last Supper. whether it was just him and the 12 or there were other people too, these guys might have been there and they saw him do that before. And then, you know, instead of saying, you know, when he disappears, instead of them saying, well, we'll just clean up the table and maybe we'll watch some TV and go to bed, they run all the way back to Jerusalem because they're so excited they can't stand themselves. I mean, they walk the 7 miles and then they run back
in the dark.
Yes, in the dark. That's a whole different story. So that's the Feast of Weeks. So it's sacrifices and grains. And then there's various offerings. You can read this, you know, you can read this for your homework. You know, there's for all of the things. You know, 7th month, you have the Feast of Trumpets. The 7th month has the most festivals in it. Because it has Rosh Hashanah, then it has Yom Kippur, then it has Feast of Weeks, Sukkot. I mean, Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. And then there's all these, you know, it's a solemn feast. You don't do any work. Then it goes into the offerings for Yom Kippur, which we know. Feast of Tabernacle goes on for a whole week. And it has more offerings than any of the other feasts. It's a festive holiday, but there's offerings all the time. Blood offering all the time, every day. Multiple. Thousands of animals. My two favorite things, of course. No, we don't want to get into that. But my Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles, is like my favorite. But, you know, the last day. And again, they develop traditions. You know, it tells you in the Torah how you celebrate it. You know, look at Passover. Lamb, kill the lamb, unleavened bread, bitter herbs, get ready to go. And it evolves into like this 4-hour dinner with eggs and bones and set a place for Elijah. And, you know, all this stuff evolved as time went on. But they added a festival to Tabernacles called the Water Festival, the Water Ceremony. And I don't know if I mentioned this in this group before, but the high priest and all the priests, they had pitchers that were made out of gold. It's amazing where they got all this gold. The pitchers that held about 2 quarts of water, solid gold, and they would all put on white vestments. And they would go from the temple down the stairs to the Pool of Siloam, which is in the old city of David. And they would each fill up their pitcher with water in the spring. Now, you know, you didn't have like 7 priests or 14 priests. You had like hundreds of priests. So there was this beautiful procession of all these guys dressed in white robes holding golden pitchers, like all marching in a line. Too bad we don't have any video of that, because it would have looked really cool. But they would take these pitchers, then they would go back up to the temple. And as they were drawing the water out of the pitcher, they would quote from Isaiah 12, with joy I draw water from the wells of salvation. And then when they go back to the temple, they walk around the altar 7 times, chanting Hosanna, Hosanna, Hosanna. And then starting with the high priest, they all pour the water out on the floor. And so there would be like this water going down through the building. And at this time, and you can see it in John 7, it says on the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stands up and said, if you're thirsty, come to me. So he's standing there, probably in a pair of sandals, maybe with that much water, you know, coming by his feet. And he's saying, if you're thirsty, come to me. How cool is that? And then they added a tradition, because it was such a great festival, they wanted to make it an extra day. And so they added a tradition called the fire ceremony the next day. And the Jews that were in diaspora did it all the time, but in Jerusalem they did it. They lit everything that could be lit. Menorahs, lamps, candles, in the whole city. So even though it was, you know, candlelight and lamplight, you know, it made like a glowing light. And this is where he said, I'm the light of the world. So he uses those traditions to teach his point. So I love the feast days. I can't even stand it. And then we get into 29. This is all going on. But let's go down to 29:40. Because, you know, remember the appointed feast, you know, right above it, it says, you know, in verse 39, it says the appointed feast. They're always called the appointed feasts, the Moedim in Hebrew, because God always does things at an appointed time. And the feast had to be celebrated at an appointed time, you know, for whatever reason God gives to it. So, for example, he wouldn't say, you know, you can have Passover. It should be sometime in April. So whatever day works out for you, you can do it. No, he says, the 10th day of the month, you get the lamb. The 14th day of the month, you slaughter the lamb. That's Passover. You know, it gives the exact time when it has to be. Then you count 10 days, you know. Then you have the Feast of Trumpets. You count 10 days, it's Yom Kippur. Then you count 15 days, and it's Tabernacles. You know, everything is like spelled out. They all, first Sabbath after Passover, next day's first fruits. I mean, everything is spelled out. Count 49 days, next day's Pentecost. It's exact, you know, to the day, appointed time. You know, Messiah, Jesus coming, he came at an appointed time. You know, why didn't he come 50 years later or 50 years earlier or 200 years later or 500 years earlier? No, had to come then. So let's read just 29:40. And Moses told the sons of Israel everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And of course, he's done that before, so he's kind of restating it even before we get to Deuteronomy. A lot of people think that that's like all this restatement is boring, but it's really important. You know, it's kind of like teaching the faith. You know, you tell the kids something over and over again. You don't just say it once. You know, Deuteronomy 6 from verse 4, you know, you teach all these things diligently to your children. Doesn't mean you mention it once, then you never mention it again. Or doesn't mean, you know, you talk about it once in a while if you feel like it. It says you teach it diligently. So you have to, like, keep doing it. And, I mean, we do the same thing. So then we're going to go into chapter 30. Is about keeping vows and when you make an oath to people and marriage vows. You can read that for your homework. But vows are very important. In fact, at Yom Kippur, if you go to a synagogue the evening of Yom Kippur, which is, you know, remember the day starts at sundown. So we would call it the eve. To them, it would be the same day. But the evening service, there's a whole prayer. There's a whole section about repenting about vows and promises that you didn't keep. So like, you know, I promised Peter I was going to help him move, and then I didn't go. You know, I promised Sandy I was going to take her to the store, and then I didn't do it, you know. So there's like this whole confession about vows and promises to people and, of course, to God, where you say, yes, Lord, you know, last year I promised I was going to, you know, and I didn't do it. So it's really a very moving thing because vows and oaths, of course, are very important. That's why Jesus says, don't swear about anything. Just yes, yes and no. Because, you know, I mean, of course, that's the whole thing of how the crime of perjury started when, you know, swearing to God meant something. I don't know now. I mean, that's still perjury, but you know, when you swear to God that you're going to tell the truth and then you don't, that's a lot different than if I tell you a lie and you have no way to know if I'm lying or not, but you swear to God what I'm telling you is true and it isn't. You bring God into your lie. So now you add whatever that would be called. We didn't put your hand on the Bible, but you raise your hand and they just read it. And they still say, so help you God. Well, that's why, you know, all through the scripture, when God says, I swear that, you know, God can't swear by anybody but himself. So he is, his name and his holiness is in that. So when God makes a promise, it says, I swear that that's going to happen. you know that it's going to happen. So vows. Now, when we get into 31, we get into wars with the Midianites. Now, I don't know how much of this you really want to read, but long story short, and you should read this for your homework. So there's war with the Midianites. Let's go to, now you may have different chapter headings, I don't know, but 31. What does your chapter 31 start with?
Extermination of the Midianites.
Okay, let me start reading there.
The Lord said to Moses, "Avenge the Israelites on the Midianites, and then you shall be taken to your people." So Moses told the people, "Select men from your midst and arm them for war, to attack the Midianites and execute the Lord's vengeance on them. From each of the tribes of Israel you shall send a band of 1,000 men to war. From the clans of Israel, therefore, 1,000 men of each tribe were levied, so that there were 12,000 men armed for war. Moses sent them out on the campaign, 1,000 from each tribe, with Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest for the campaign, who had with him the sacred vessels and the trumpets for sounding the alarm. They waged war against the Midianites as the Lord had commanded Moses, and killed every male among them. Besides those slain in battle, they killed the 5 Midianite kings, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba. They also executed Balaam, son of Beor, with the sword."
That's our Balaam.
That's last week.
He dies in this battle.
Mm-hmm. Is he the prophet or the king? I forget.
He's the prophet.
Okay. "But the Israelites kept the women of the Midianites with their little ones as captives, and all their herds and flocks and wealth as spoil, while they set on fire all the towns where they had settled and all their encampments. Then they took all the booty with the people and beasts they had captured and brought the captives together with the spoils and booty to Moses and the priest Eleazar and to the Israelite community at their camp on the plains of Moab along the Jericho stretch of the Jordan."
Okay, so they're just to the east of the land. They're just to the east of the Jordan. Jericho's right across the river. And they have this battle where they killed every man. They took the women, the booty, the riches. They took the animals and stuff. Because God said this is going to be vengeance for what the Midianites had done to the Israelites. And then when they get back in the land, there's always going to be friction with the Midianites. And what's going to happen here is because of what the soldiers did, and God commanded them to do it, they had to stay outside the camp for 7 days because they had been in contact with dead people. So it would take 7 days to purify themselves. They had to stay outside the camp. So remember when they left Egypt, they were like, "We don't know how to fight wars." Well, I didn't know how to fight wars. 12,000 guys. Moses gets upset. So keep reading there at 13.
"When Moses and the priest Eleazar with all the princes of the community went outside the camp to meet them, Moses became angry with the officers of the army, the clan, and the company commanders who were returning from combat. 'So you have spared all the women?' he exclaimed. 'Why, they are the very ones who on Balaam's advice prompted the unfaithfulness of the Israelites toward the Lord in the Peor affair, which began the slaughter of the Lord's community. Slay, therefore, every male child and every woman who has had intercourse with a man. But you may spare and keep for yourselves all girls who have no intercourse with a man. Moreover, you shall stay outside the camp for 7 days, and those of you who have slain anyone or touched anyone slain in battle shall purify yourselves on the third and on the seventh day. This applies both to you and to your captives. You shall also purify every article of cloth, leather, goat's hair, or wood.' Eleazar the priest told the soldiers who had returned from combat, 'This is what the law, as prescribed by the Lord to Moses, ordains. Whatever can stand fire, such as gold, silver, bronze, iron, tin, and lead, you shall put into the fire, that it may become clean. However, it must also be purified with lustral water. But whatever cannot stand fire, you shall put into the water. On the seventh day you shall wash your clothes, and then you will again be clean. After that you may enter the camp.
Yeah. So Moses gets mad that they didn't kill the women. So they go back and they kill all the women that have either have children or have had intercourse with a man. And so they, you know, the only people spared are the younger girls. And it says there it's a command from the Lord. God does not want the people to be contaminated. We're going to go into some more stuff where he's going to say, go into that town and kill everybody, men, women, children, even the livestock. Don't take anything. Don't hang out over there. They're tough sayings. Tough sayings. And during all this, not a single Israelite is killed in this battle. But now something interesting happens. My time is moving along. Something interesting happens because they're to the east of the river. Some of the people like it there because there's good pasture land. So the tribe of Reuben and Gad and part of the tribe of Ephraim want to stay on the east side of the river. Manasseh. It's Manasseh, not Ephraim. So Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh want to stay on the east side of the Jordan. In other words, they don't want to go into the land. They like it there. They like the pasture land. Moses says, well, okay, maybe we can do that, but your men have to fight with us while we take over the land. Then once the land is taken over, you can come back and live here if you want. So basically, they built little shelters and stuff for their wives and children, and the men went to fight. And then when the battles were over and everything was secure, they went back to live on the east side of the river because they liked it for the livestock. And Moses gets upset because he's thinking, you know, this is not the promised land. And you're being disobedient just like the 10 of the 12 spies were. And he was worried that God was going to punish them again, but he doesn't. He says it's okay as long as your men go and fight. So they stay there. That's kind of a gee whiz thing. Now, Reuben's problem was he had delis, a chain of delis. That's how franchising got started. Ah, you guys got to.
Yeah,
the original. Then in chapter 33, he recounts the Exodus from Egypt again and the wandering in the wilderness. Goes through all of the things that we read about months ago. Like restates it, like almost word for word. And then let's go down to verse, this is 33:50. I hope it lines up.
The Lord spoke to Moses on the plains of Moab beside the Jericho stretch of the Jordan and said to him, tell the Israelites, when you go across the Jordan into the land of Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their stone figures and molten images and demolish all their high places. You shall take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you the land as your property. You shall apportion the land among yourselves by lot, clan by clan, assigning a large heritage to a large group and a small heritage to a small group. Wherever anyone's lot falls, there shall his property be within the heritage of his ancestral tribe. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, those whom you allow to remain will become as barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they will harass you in the country where you live, and I will treat you as I had intended to treat them.
Okay. How intense is that?
Wow. Yeah.
So you're going to go into the land, you're going to drive out everybody. Everybody who's there, you're going to drive. I'm doing this for you. I'm telling you, I'm giving you the land. These people are going to, they're not going to defeat you. You're just going to go in and you're going to do it. And then the land's going to be divided among the tribes by their size. So that's where that last census we talked about, like the numbers from each tribe. So if you're a really big tribe, you get a much bigger piece of land than if you're a really small tribe. And as we're going to see, the Levites get no land. So Moses tells the people that when we divide the land, Reuben, Gad, and part of Manasseh can stay on the other side of the river. The rest of the land is going to be divided among all y'all. And the Levites aren't going to have any actual territory, but they're going to be in some cities with pasture land around them. And it's about a tenth of the total. It's less than a tenth of 1% of the total land. And of course, they're going to be supported by the tithe. All the other tribes are going to support them. So Moses is now telling the people, you're actually going to go into the land now. I mean, up to now, it's been kind of like, is this ever going to happen? I mean, we've already been out here for, 38 and three quarter years. Are we ever going to act 39 and three quarter years? So now this is actually going to happen, and we're going to divide the land up among the tribes by size. The Levites aren't going to get land because God is their inheritance. But they're going to get these little pockets because, remember, the Levites are the priests. They're the ministers. So you have to have some ministry going on in outlying areas where you can't just have all the Levites be in one place. So there's going to be some Levites scattered around. And they're going to make six cities of refuge. Now, a city of refuge was for people who have committed what we'd call manslaughter would go to. So that, I'll pick on Peter again. So if Peter and I have some kind of dispute and we get into a fight and, I punch him in the head and instead of just falling down, he like falls over and dies. Now, I didn't mean to kill him. Or if I punch him and he hits his head on the wall and dies, that's what we would call manslaughter. But then his family might come after me. You're the guy who killed him, so we're coming after you. So I would run to a city of refuge where I'd be protected. And the Levites were kind of in charge of these things. And they would whatever you'd call it, adjudicate the thing. So they might say, yes, this is manslaughter. Or they might say, no, what you did is murder, so you're not protected. It was kind of like a system of justice. But there were six cities of refuge. The point of the cities was they didn't want revenge. But murderers are always put to death. I mean, if somebody says, oh, no, this is murder what you did, they'd be put to death. And it goes through, if you read through there in chapter 35, it goes through these things. You hit somebody and they die. You didn't mean to kill them. But, if it's different than if you take out your knife, if he and I are arguing and I punch him, he punches me, then I take out a knife and stab him three times and he dies. Well, that's clearly not manslaughter because I'm killing him. Then you get the death penalty. And it is a death penalty. So let's go down to verse 29. 35:29.
These shall be norms for you and all your descendants wherever you live for rendering judgment. Whenever someone kills another, the evidence of witnesses is required for the execution of the murderer. The evidence of a single witness is not sufficient for putting a person to death. You shall not accept indemnity in place of the life of a murderer who deserves the death penalty. He must be put to death. nor shall you accept indemnity to allow a refugee to leave his city of asylum and again dwell elsewhere in the land before the death of the high priest. You shall not desecrate the land where you live. Since bloodshed desecrates the land, and the land can have no atonement for the blood shed on it, except through the blood of him who shed it. Do not defile the land in which you live, and in the midst of which I dwell, for I am the Lord who dwells in the midst of the Israelites.
So, blood defiles the land. Shed blood defiles the land. So imagine what our shed blood is. Abortion. I mean, the whole world, not just here, but most of the world does it now. Shed blood defiles the land. And, you know, it doesn't just ruin people. It even defiles the land. And according to this, you know, you can't make expiation for the land except to shed the blood of the person who shed the blood in the first place. So in other words, a murderer has to be executed. So this kind of restates that. So again, what he's saying here is, you know, if I take out the knife and stab him three times and he dies, and people say to me, oh, okay, you're going to get, you know, 2 months in the house arrest and then you can go free. The blood I shed from him defiles the land, and unless I'm killed, the land's still defiled because there's not justice. And so now we're actually to the end of Numbers. So look how Numbers ends if you read 36:13. And there's stuff about women inheritance. I mean, all this, you know, these are all laws that are important at the time. I mean, they don't apply to us in the sense of civil or spiritual matters, right? I mean, women had basically no rights of inheritance or anything. They had no rights at all. And this is why there's so much provision for widows and orphans. Because imagine you're a 28-year-old woman and you got three kids and your husband dies. You're in big trouble. I mean, if your family helps support you, that's great. You go glean in the field and, you know, go to the vineyards and take the nuts off the trees and, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, you don't get a part-time job and you don't go on welfare and you don't, you know, you're not a viable economic unit. Now, you know, I'm not sure what would happen if somebody was, you know, if somebody was wealthy in the sense that they had a lot of stuff and they died. I'm not sure what a woman would get out of that, but I don't think it would automatically pass to the wife. Somebody read the last verse of Numbers, which is 36:13.
These are the commandments and decisions which the Lord prescribed for the Israelites through Moses on the plains of Moab, beside the Jericho stretch of the Jordan.
And so it's emphasized again here. They're on the plains of Moab at the Jordan, right across from Jericho. They're like right at the land. So, in other words, what God's saying here is, here's all the commandments I gave Moses. You guys all know them now. Everything's all set now. We're going to go. But don't forget this covenant that we have. It's been explained to you more than once, multiple times. Like if you don't know by now that you have to keep the Sabbath, there's no hope for you. You know, we've only said it like 58 times. You know, if you don't know by now that you don't, you know, do this or do that, you know, gave you all this law, now we're going into the land, so you got to remember all this stuff. So next time we'll start Deuteronomy.